pulling them away reveals the candied lower teeth against the pulpy gums. And if the smoker is a blower of smoke rings, you get to see all the way into the dark velvet of the inner cheeks. That's how it went with the obscure object. A cigarette in bed was the tombstone marking each day's end, and the reed through which she breathed herself back to life each morning. You heard of installation artists? Well, the object was an exhalation artist. She had a whole repertoire. There was the sidewinder, where she politely funneled smoke away from the person she was talking to out the corner of her mouth. There was the geyser when she was angry. There was the dragon lady, featuring a plume from each nostril. There was the French recycle, where she let smoke out her mouth only to inhale it back through her nose. And there was the swallow. The swallow was reserved for crisis situations. Once, in the science wing bathroom, the object had just finished taking a long drag when a teacher charged in. My friend had time to flick her cigarette into the toilet bowl and flush. But what about the smoke? Where could it go? "Who's been smoking in here?" the teacher asked. The object shrugged, keeping her mouth closed. The teacher leaned toward her, sniffing, and the object swallowed. No smoke came out. Not a wisp, not a puff. A little moistness in her eyes, the only sign of the Chernobyl in her lungs. I accepted the object's invitation to sleep over. Mrs. Object called Tessie to see if it was all right, and by 11 o'clock, my friend and I went up to bed together. She gave me a T-shirt to wear. It said Fessenden on the front. I put it on, and the object snickered. "What?" "That's Jerome's T-shirt. Does it reek?" "Why'd you give me his shirt?" I said, going stiff, shrinking from the cotton's touch while still wearing it. "Mine are too small. You want one of Daddy's? They smell like cologne." "Your dad wears cologne?" "He lived in Paris after the war. He's got all kinds of fruity habits." She was climbing up into the big bed now. "Plus, he slept with about 1 million French prostitutes."
"He told you that?"
"Not exactly. But whenever Daddy talks about France, he acts all horny. He was in the army there. He was like in charge of running Paris after the war, and Mummy gets really pissed when he talks about it."
She imitated her mother now.
"That's enough francophilia for one evening, dear." As usual, when she did something dramatic, her IQ suddenly soared. Then she flopped onto her stomach. "He killed people, too."
"He did?"
"Yeah," said the object, adding by way of explanation, "Nazis." I climbed into the big bed. At home, I had one pillow. Here, there were six. "Back rub," the object called out cheerily. "I'll do you if you do me. Deal." I sat astride her, on the saddle of her hips, and started with her shoulders. Her hair was in the way, so I moved it. We were quiet for a while, me rubbing, and then I asked, "Have you ever been to a gynecologist?" The object nodded into her pillow. "What's it like?"
"It's torture. I hate it."
"What do they do?" "First they make you strip and put this little gown on. It's made of paper, and all this cold air gets in. You freeze. Then they make you lie on this table, spread-eagled."
"Spread-eagled?"
"Yep. You have to put your legs in these metal things. Then the gyno gives you a pelvic exam, which kills."
"What do you mean, pelvic exam?"
"I thought you were supposed to be the sex expert. Come on. A pelvic exam is, you know, inside. They shove this little doohickey in you to spread you all open and everything."
"I can't believe this.
It kills. And it's freezing. Plus, you've got the gyno making lame jokes while he's nosing around in there. But the worst is what he does with his hands."
"What?"
"Basically, he reaches in until he can tickle your tonsils." Now I was mute, absolutely paralyzed with shock and fear. "Who are you going to?" the object asked.
"Someone named Dr. Bauer."
"Dr. Bauer? That's Renee's dad. He's a total perv."
"What do you mean?"
"I went swimming over at Renee's one time. They have a pool. Dr. Bauer came out and stood there watching. Then he goes, 'Your legs have perfect proportions, absolutely perfect proportions.' Oh, God, what a perv, Dr. Bauer. I pity you."
She raised her stomach in order to free her shirt. I massaged her lower back, reaching under the shirt to knead her shoulder blades. The object got quiet after that. So did I. I kept my mind off gynecology by losing myself in the back rub. It wasn't hard. Her honey or apricot-colored back tapered at the waist in a way mine didn't. There were white spots here and there, anti-freckles. Wherever I rubbed, her skin flushed. I was aware of the blood underneath coursing and draining. Her underarms were rough like a cat's tongue. Below them, the sides of her breasts swelled out, flattened against the mattress. "Okay," I said after a long while. "My turn." But that night was like all the others. She was asleep. It was never my turn with the object. They come back to me, the scattered days of that summer with the object, each encased in a souvenir snow globe. Let me shake them up again. Watch the flakes float down. We are lying in bed together on a Saturday morning. The object is on her back. I'm fulcrumed on one elbow, leaning over to inspect her face. "You know what sleep is," I say.
"What?"
"Snot."
"It is not."
"It is. It's mucus. It's snot that comes out your eyes."
"That's so gross."
"You've got a little sleep in your eyes, my dear," I say in a fake deep voice. With my finger, I flick the crust from the object's eyelashes.
"I can't believe I'm letting you do this," she says. "You're touching my snot." We look at each other a moment.
"I'm touching your snot," I scream, and we writhe around, throwing pillows and screaming some more.
On another day, the object is taking a bath. She has her own bathroom. I'm on the bed reading a gossip magazine.
"You can tell Jane Fonda isn't really naked in that movie," I say.
"How?"
"She's got a body stocking on. You can see it."
I go into the bathroom to show her. In the claw-footed tub, under a layer of whipped cream, the object lolls, pumicing one heel. She looks at the photograph and says,
"You're never naked either."
I am frozen speechless. "Do you have some kind of complex?"
"No, I don't have a complex."
"What are you afraid of, then?"
"I'm not afraid."
The object knows this isn't true, but her intentions aren't malicious. She isn't trying to catch me out, only to put me at ease. My modesty baffles her.
"I don't know what you're so worried about," she says. "You're my best friend."
I pretend to be engrossed in the magazine. I can't get myself to look away. Inside, however, I'm bursting with happiness. I'm erupting with joy. But I keep staring at the magazine as though I'm mad at it. It's late. We've stayed up watching TV. The object is brushing her teeth when I come into the bathroom. I pull down my underpants and sit on the toilet. I do this sometimes as a compensatory tactic. The t-shirt is long enough to cover my lap. I pee while the object brushes. It's then I smell smoke. Looking up, I see besides a toothbrush in the object's mouth, a cigarette.
"You even smoke while you brush your teeth?"
She looks at me sideways. "Menthol," she says.
The thing about those souvenirs, though,
the glitter falls fast. A reminder taped to our refrigerator brought me back to reality. Dr. Bauer, July 22nd, 2 p.m. I was filled with dread. Dread of the perverted gynecologist and his inquisitorial instruments. Dread of the metal things that would spread my legs and of the doohickey that would spread something else. And dread of what all this spreading might reveal. It was in this state, this emotional foxhole, that I started going to church again. One Sunday in early July, my mother and I dressed up, Tessie in heels, me not, and drove down to Assumption. Tessie was suffering too. It had been 6 months since Chapter 11 had sped away from Middlesex on his motorcycle, and since that time he hadn't been back. Worse, in April, he had broken the news that he was dropping out of college. He was planning to move to the Upper Peninsula with some friends and, as he put it, live off the land.
"You don't think he'd do something crazy like run off and marry that Meg, do you?" Tessie asked Milton.
"Let's hope not," he answered.
Tessie worried that Chapter 11 wasn't taking care of himself either. He wasn't going to the dentist regularly. His vegetarianism made him pale. And he was losing his hair. At the age of 20, this made Tessie feel suddenly old. United in anxiety, seeking solace for differing complaints, Tessie wanting to get rid of her pains while I wanted mine to begin, we entered the church. As far as I could tell, what happened every Sunday at Assumption Greek Orthodox Church was that the priests got together and read the Bible out loud. They started with Genesis and kept going straight through Numbers and Deuteronomy, then on through Psalms and Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, all the way up to the New Testament. Then they read that. Given the length of our services, I saw no other possibility. They chanted as the church slowly filled up. Finally, the central chandelier flicked on, and Father Mike, like a life-size puppet, sprang through the icon screen. The transformation my uncle went through every Sunday always amazed me. At church, Father Mike appeared and disappeared with the capriciousness of a divinity. One minute, he was up on the balcony, singing in his tender, tone-deaf voice. The next minute, he was back on ground level, swinging his censer, glittering, bejeweled. As overdone in his vestments as a Fabergé egg, he promenaded around the church, giving us God's blessing. Sometimes his censer produced so much smoke, it seemed that Father Mike had the ability to cloak himself in a mist. When the mist dispersed, however, later that afternoon in our living room, he was once again a short, shy man in black polyester blend clothes and a plastic collar. Aunt Zoe's authority went in the opposite direction. At church, she was meek. The round gray hat she wore looked like the head of a screw fastening her to her pew. She was constantly pinching her sons to keep them awake. I could barely connect the anxious person hunched down every week in front of us to the funny woman who, under the inspiration of wine, launched into comedy routines in our kitchen. "You men, stay out!" she'd shout, dancing with my mother. "We've got knives in here!" So startling was the contrast between church-going Zoe and wine-drinking Zoe that I always made a point of watching her closely during the liturgy. On most Sundays, when my mother tapped her on the shoulder in greeting, Aunt Zoe responded only with a weak smile. Her large nose looked swollen with grief. Then she turned back, crossed herself, and settled in for the duration. And so, Assumption Church that July morning, incense rising with the pungency of irrational hope. Closer in, it had been drizzling out, the smell of wet wool, the dripping of umbrellas stashed under pews. The rivulets from these umbrellas flowing down the uneven floor of our poorly built church, pooling in spots. The smell of hairspray and perfume, of cheap cigars, and the slow ticking of watches. The grumbling of more and more stomachs, and the yawning, the nodding off, and the snoring, and the being elbowed awake. Our liturgy, endless, my own body immune to the laws of time. And right in front of me, Zoe Antoniou, on whom time had also been doing a number. The life of a priest's wife had been even worse than Aunt Zoe had expected. She had hated her years in the Peloponnese. They had lived in a small, unheated stone house. Outside, the village women spread blankets under olive trees, beating the branches until the olives fell. "Can't they stop that damn racket?" Zoe had complained. In 5 years, to the incessant sound of trees being clubbed to death, she bore 4 children. She sent letters to my mother detailing her hardships. No washing machine, no car, no television, a backyard full of boulders and goats. She signed her letters, "Saint Zoe, Church Martyr." Father Mike had liked Greece better. His years there represented the best period of his priesthood. In that tiny Peloponnesian village, the old superstition survived. People still believed in the evil eye. Nobody pitied him for being a priest, whereas later on in America, his parishioners always treated him with a slight but unmistakable condescension, like a crazy person whose delusions had to be humored. The humiliation of being a priest in a market economy didn't plague Father Mike while he was in Greece. In Greece, he could forget about my mother who had jilted him, and he could escape comparison with my father who made so much more money. His wife's nagging complaints hadn't begun to make Father Mike think about leaving the priesthood yet, and hadn't led him to his desperate act. In 1956, Father Mike was reappointed stateside to a church in Cleveland. In 1958, he became a priest at Assumption. Zoe was happy to be back home, but she never got used to her position as presbytera. She didn't like being a role model. She found it difficult to keep her children looking neat and well-dressed.
"On what money?" she shouted at her husband. "Maybe if they paid you halfway decent, the kids would look better."
My cousins, Aristotle, Socrates, Cleopatra, and Plato, had the thwarted, overbrushed look of ministers' children. The boys wore cheap, garishly colored double-breasted suits. They had afros. Cleo, who was as beautiful and almond-eyed as her namesake, made do with dresses from Montgomery Ward. She rarely spoke and played cat's cradle with Plato during the service. I always liked Aunt So. I liked her big, grandstanding voice. I liked her sense of humor. She was louder than most men. She could make my mother laugh like nobody else. That Sunday, for instance, during one of the many lulls, Aunt So turned around and dared to joke.
"I have to be here, Tessie. What's your excuse?"
"Callie and I just felt like coming to church," my mother answered. Plato, who was small like his father, sang out with mock censure,
"Shame on you, Callie. What did you do?"
He rubbed his right index finger repeatedly over his left.
"Nothing," I said.
"Hey, Sock," Plato whispered to his brother, "is cousin Callie blushing?
She must have done something she doesn't want to tell us."
"Shush up now, you," said Aunt Zoe.
For Father Mike was approaching with the censer. My cousins turned around. My mother bowed her head to pray. I did too. Tessie prayed for Chapter 11 to come to his senses. And me? That's easy. I prayed for my period to come. I prayed to receive the womanly stigmata. Summer sped on. Milton brought our suitcases up from the basement and told my mother and me to start packing. I tanned with the object at the little club. Dr. Bauer haunted my mind, judging the proportions of my legs. The appointment was a week away, then half a week, then 2 days. And so we come to the preceding Saturday night, July 20th, 1974, a night full of departures and secret plans. In the early hours of Sunday morning, which was still Saturday night back in Michigan, Turkish jets took off from bases on the mainland. They headed southeast over the Mediterranean Sea toward the island of Cyprus. In the ancient myths, gods favoring mortals often hid them away. Aphrodite blotted out Paris once, saving him from certain death at the hands of Menelaus. She wrapped Aeneas in a coat to sneak him off the battlefield. Likewise, as the Turkish jets roared over the sea, they were also hidden. That night, Cypriot military personnel reported a mysterious malfunctioning of their radar screens. The screens filled with thousands of white blips, an electromagnetic cloud. Invisible inside this, the Turkish jets reached the island and began dropping their bombs. Meanwhile, back in Grosse Pointe, Fred and Phyllis Mooney were also leaving home base, heading to Chicago. On the front porch, waving goodbye, stood their children, Woody and Jane, who had secret plans of their own. Flying toward the Mooney's house at that moment were the silver bombers of beer kegs and the tight formations of six-packs. Cars full of teenagers were on their way, and so were the object and I. Powdered and glossed, our hair hot-combed into wings, we had set off for the party ourselves. In thin corduroy skirts and clogs, we came up the front lawn. But the object stopped me on the porch before we went in. She was biting her lip. "You're my best friend, right?"
"Right. Okay. Sometimes I think I have bad breath."
She stopped.
"The thing is, you can never tell if you have bad breath or not. So the thing is..."
She paused.
"I want you to check it for me."
I didn't know what to say, and so said nothing.
"Is that too disgusting?"
"No," I said finally.
"Okay, here goes."
She leaned toward me and huffed a single breath into my face.
"It's okay," I said.
"Good. Now you."
I leaned down and exhaled in her face.
"It's fine," she said decisively.
"Okay, now we can go to the party."
I'd never been to a party before. I felt for the parents. As we squeezed by the throngs in the throbbing house, I cringed at the destruction underway. Cigarette ashes were dropping on Pierre Deux upholstery. Beer cans were spilling onto heirloom carpets. In the den, I saw two laughing boys urinating into a tennis trophy. It was mostly older kids. A few couples climbed the stairs, disappearing into bedrooms. The object was trying to act older herself. She was copying the superior bored expressions of the high school girls. She crossed the back porch ahead of me and got in line for the keg. "What are you doing?" I asked. "I'm getting a beer. What do you think?" It was fairly dark outside. As in most social situations, I let my hair fall into my face. I was standing behind the object, looking like Cousin It, when someone put his hands over my eyes. "Guess who?" "Jerome." I pulled his hands off my face and turned around. "How'd you know it was me?" "The curious smell." "Ouch," said a voice behind Jerome. I looked over and received a shock. Standing with Jerome was Rex Reese, the guy who had driven Carol Henkel to her watery death. Rex Reese, our local Teddy Kennedy. He didn't look particularly sober now either. His dark hair covered his ears, and he wore a piece of blue coral on a leather thong around his throat. I searched his face for signs of remorse or repentance. Rex wasn't searching my face, however. He was eyeing the object, his hair falling into his eyes above the curl of a smile. Deftly, the two boys moved in between us, turning their backs to each other. I had a final glimpse of the obscure object. She had her hands in the back pockets of her corduroy skirt. This looked casual, but had the effect of pushing out her chest. She was looking up at Rex and smiling.
"I start filming tomorrow," Jerome said.
I looked blank.
"My movie? My vampire movie? You sure you don't want to be in it?"
"We're going on vacation this week."
"Ah, that sucks," said Jerome. "It's going to be genius."
We stood silent. After a moment, I said,
"Real geniuses never think they're geniuses."
"Who says?"
"Me."
"Because why?"
"Because genius is 9/10 perspiration. Haven't you ever heard that? As soon as you think you're a genius, you slack off. You think everything you do is so great and everything."
"I just want to make scary movies," Jerome replied, "with occasional nudity."
"Just don't try to be a genius, and maybe you'll end up being one by accident," I said.
He was looking at me in a funny way, intense but also grinning.
"What?" "Nothing." "Why are you looking at me like that?"
"Looking at you like what?" In the dark, Jerome's resemblance to the obscure object was even more pronounced. The tawny eyebrows, the butterscotch complexion. Here they were again in permissible form.
"You're a lot smarter than most of my sister's friends."
"You're a lot smarter than most of my friend's brothers." He leaned toward me. He was taller than I was. That was the big difference between him and his sister. It was enough to wake me from my trance. I turned away. I circled around him back to the object. She was still staring up, bright-faced, at Rex.
"Come on," I said. "We've got to go to that thing."
"What thing?"
"You know, that thing."
Finally, I managed to pull her away. She left trailing smiles and significant looks. As soon as we got off the porch, she was frowning at me.
"Where are you taking me?" she said angrily. "Away from that creep. Can't you leave me alone for a minute?"
"You want me to leave you alone?" I said.
"Okay, I'll leave you alone."
I didn't move.
"Can't I even talk to a boy at a party?" the object asked. "I was taking you away before it was too late."
"What do you mean?"
"You've got bad breath."
This checked the object. This struck her to her core. She wilted.
"I do?" she asked.
"It's just a little oniony," I said. We were on the back lawn now. Kids were sitting on the stone porch rail, their cigarette tips glowing in the darkness.
"What do you think of Rex?" the object whispered.
"What?
Oh, don't tell me you like him." "I didn't say I like him."
I scoped her face, seeking the answer. She noticed this and walked farther away over the lawn. I followed. I said earlier that most of my emotions are hybrids, but not all. Some are pure and unadulterated. Jealousy, for instance.
"Rex is okay," I said when I caught up to her. "If you like manslaughterers."
"That was an accident," said the object. The moon was 3/4 full. It silvered the fat leaves of the trees. The grass was wet. We both kicked off our clogs to stand in it. After a moment, sighing, the object laid her head on my shoulder.
"It's good you're going away," she said.
"Why?"
"Because this is too weird."
I looked back to see if anyone could see us. No one could. So I put my arm around her. For the next few minutes, we stood under the moon-blanched trees, listening to the music blaring from the house. The cops would come soon. The cops always came. That was something you could depend on in Grosse Pointe. The next morning, I went to church with Tessie. As usual, Aunt Zoe was down in front, setting an example. Aristotle, Socrates, and Plato were wearing their gangster suits. Cleo was sunk into her black mane, about to doze off. The rear and sides of the church were dark. Icons, gloomed from the porticos, or raised stiff fingers in the glinting chapels. Beneath the dome, light fell in a chalky beam. The air was already thick with incense. Moving back and forth, the priests looked like men at a hamam. Then it was showtime. One priest flicked a switch. The bottom tier of the enormous chandelier blazed on. From behind the iconostasis, Father Mike entered. He was wearing a bright turquoise robe with a red heart embroidered on his back. He crossed the solia and came down among the parishioners. The smoke from his censer rose and curled, fragrant with antiquity. "Kyrie eleison," Father Mike sang. "Kyrie eleison." And though the words meant nothing to me, or almost nothing, I felt their weight, the deep groove they made in the air of time. Tessie crossed herself, thinking about Chapter 11. First, Father Mike did the left side of the church. In blue waves, incense rolled over the gathered heads. It dimmed the circular lights of the chandelier. It aggravated the widow's lung conditions. It subdued the brightness of my cousin's suits. As it wrapped me in its dry ice blanket, I breathed it in and began to pray myself, "Please, God, let Dr. Bauer not find anything wrong with me, and let me be just friends with the object, and don't let her forget about me while we're in Turkey, and help my mother not to be so worried about my brother, and make Chapter 11 go back to college." Incense serves a variety of purposes in the Orthodox Church. Symbolically, it's an offering to God. Like the burnt sacrifices in pagan times, the fragrance drifts up toward heaven. Before the days of modern embalming, incense had a practical application. It covered the smell of corpses during funerals. It can also, when inhaled in sufficient amounts, create a lightheadedness that feels like religious reverie. And if you breathe in enough of it, it can make you sick. "What's the matter?" Tessie's voice in my ear. "You look pale." I stopped praying and opened my eyes. "I do? Do you feel okay?" I began to answer in the affirmative, but then I stopped myself. "You look really pale, Callie," Tessie said again. She touched her hand to my forehead. Sickness, reverie, devotion, deceit, they all came together. If God doesn't help you, you have to help yourself. "It's my stomach," I said. "What have you been eating?" "Or not exactly my stomach. It's lower down." "Do you feel faint?" Father Mike passed by again. He swung the censer so high it nearly touched the tip of my nose, and I widened my nostrils and breathed in as much smoke as possible to make myself even paler than I already was. "It's like somebody's twisting something inside me," I hazarded, which must have been more or less right, because Tessie was now smiling. "Oh, honey," she said. "Oh, thank God." "You're happy I'm sick? Thanks a lot." "You're not sick, honey." "Then what am I? I don't feel good. It hurts." My mother took my hand, still beaming. "Hurry, hurry," she said. "We don't want an accident." By the time I closed myself into a church bathroom stall, news of the Turkish invasion of Cyprus had reached the United States. When Tessie and I arrived back home, the living room was filled with shouting men.
"Our battleships are sitting off the coast to intimidate the Greeks," Jimmy Fioritos was yelling. "Sure they're sitting off the coast, Milton, now. What do you expect? The junta comes in and throws Makarios out? So the Turks are getting anxious. It's a volatile situation." "Yeah, but to help the Turks." "The U.S. isn't helping the Turks," Milton went on. "They just don't want the junta to get out of hand."
In 1922, while Smyrna burned, American warships sat idly by. 52 years later, off the coast of Cyprus, they also did nothing. At least, ostensibly.
Don't be so naive, Milt. Jimmy Fioritos again. Who do you think's jamming the radar? It's the Americans, Milt. It's us.
How do you know? My father challenged. And now Gus Panos threw the hole in his throat.
It's that goddamn Kissinger. He must have made a deal with the Turks.
Of course he did, Peter Tatakis nodded, sipping his Pepsi. Now that the Vietnam crisis is over, Herr Dr. Kissinger can get back to playing Bismarck. He would like to see NATO bases in Turkey. This is his way to get them.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Were these accusations true? I can't say for sure. All I know is this. On that morning, somebody jammed the Cypriot radar, guaranteeing the success of the Turkish invasion. Did the Turks possess such technology? No. Did the U.S. warships? Yes. But this isn't something you can prove. Plus, it didn't matter to me anyway. The men cursed and shook their fingers at the television and pounded the radio until Aunt Zoe unplugged them. Unfortunately, she couldn't unplug the men. All through dinner, the men shouted at each other. Knives and forks waved in the air. The argument over Cyprus lasted for weeks and would finally put an end to those Sunday dinners once and for all. But as for myself, the invasion had only one meaning. As soon as I could, I excused myself and ran off to call the object.
Guess what? I cried out with excitement. We're not going on vacation. There's a war.
Then I told her I had cramps and that I'd be right over. Flesh and blood. I'm quickly approaching the moment of discovery. Of myself, by myself, which was something I knew all along and yet didn't know. And the discovery by poor half-blind Dr. Philibosian of what he'd failed to notice at my birth and continued to miss during every annual physical thereafter. And the discovery by my parents of what kind of child they'd given birth to. Answer? The same child, only different. And finally, the discovery of the mutated gene that had lain buried in our bloodline for 250 years, biding its time, waiting for Ataturk to attack, for Hagi Anistis to turn into glass, for a clarinet to play seductively out a back window until coming together with its recessive twin, it started the chain of events that led up to me, here, writing in Berlin. That summer, while the president's lies were also getting more elaborate, I started faking my period. With Nixonian cunning, Calliope unwrapped and flushed away a flotilla of unused Tampax. I feigned symptoms from headache to fatigue. I did cramps the way Meryl Streep did accents. There was the twinge, the dull ache, the sucker punch that made me curl up on my bed. My cycle, though imaginary, was rigorously charted on my desk calendar. I used the catacomb fish symbol to mark the days. I scheduled my periods right through December, by which time I was certain my real menage would have finally arrived. My deception worked. It calmed my mother's anxieties and somehow even my own. I felt I'd taken charge of things. I wasn't at the mercy of nature anymore. Even better, with our trip to Bursa canceled as well as my appointment with Dr. Bauer, I was free to accept the object's invitation to visit her family's summer house. In preparation, I bought a sun hat, sandals, and a pair of rustic overalls. I wasn't particularly tuned into the political events unfolding in the nation that summer, but it was impossible to miss what was going on. My father's identification with Nixon only grew stronger as the president's troubles mounted. In the long-haired war protesters, Milton saw his own shaggy, condemnatory son. Now, in the Watergate scandal, my father recognized his own dubious behavior during the riots. He thought the break-in was a mistake, but also believed that it was no big deal.
You don't think the Democrats aren't doing the same thing? Milton asked the Sunday debaters. The liberals just want to stick it to them, so they're playing pious.
Watching the evening news, Milton delivered a running commentary to the screen.
Oh, yeah, he'd say, bullshit, or... This guy Proxmire's a total zero. Or, What these pointy-headed intellectuals should be worrying about is foreign policy. What to do about the goddamn Russians and the Red Chinese, not pissing and moaning about a robbery at a lousy campaign office.
Hunkered down behind his TV tray, Milton scowled at the left-wing press, and his growing resemblance to the president couldn't be ignored. On weeknights, he argued with the television, but on Sundays, he faced a live audience. Uncle Pete, who was usually as dormant as a snake while digesting, was now animated and jovial.
Even from a chiropractic standpoint, Nixon is a questionable character. He has the skeleton of a chimpanzee. Father Mike joined the needling. So what do you think about your friend Tricky Dicky now, Milt?
I think it's a lot of hoo-ha.
Things got worse when the conversation turned to Cyprus. In domestic affairs, Milton had Jimmy Fioritos on his side. But when it came to the Cyprus situation, they parted company. A month after the invasion, just as the UN was about to conclude a peace negotiation, the Turkish army had launched another attack. This time, the Turks claimed a large portion of the island. Now barbed wire was going up. Guard towers were being erected. Cyprus was being cut in half like Berlin, like Korea, like all the other places in the world that were no longer one thing or the other.
Now they're showing their true stripes, Jimmy Fiorito said. The Turks wanted to invade all along. That malarkey about protecting the Constitution was just a pretext.
They hit us while our backs were turned,
croaked Gus Panos. Milton snorted.
What do you mean us? Where were you born, Gus? Cyprus? You know what I mean?
America betrayed the Greeks, Jimmy Fioritos jabbed a finger in the air.
It's that two-faced son of a bitch Kissinger. Shakes your hand while he pisses in your pocket.
Milton shook his head. He lowered his chin aggressively and made a little sound, a bark of disapproval deep in his throat.
We have to do whatever's in our national interest.
And then Milton lifted his chin and said it.
To hell with the Greeks!
In 1974, instead of reclaiming his roots by visiting Bursa, my father renounced them. Forced to choose between his native land and his ancestral one, he didn't hesitate. Meanwhile, we could hear it all the way from the kitchen, shouting and a coffee cup breaking, swear words in both English and Greek, feet stomping out of the house.
Get your coat, Phyllis. We're leaving,
Jimmy Fiorito said.
It's summer, said Phyllis. I don't have a coat.
Then get whatever the hell is you have to get.
We're going to... I've lost my... appetite.
Even Uncle Pete, the self-educated opera buff, drew the line.
Maybe Gus didn't grow up in Greece, he said. But I'm sure you remember that I did. You're talking about my native land, Milton. And your parents' own true home.
The guests left. They didn't come back. Jimmy and Phyllis Fioritos, Gus and Helen Panos, Peter Tatakis, the Buicks pulled away from Middlesex, leaving behind a negative space in our living room. After that, there were no more Sunday dinners, no more large-nosed men blowing their noses like muted trumpets, no more cheek-pinching women who resembled Melina Mercury in her later years. Most of all, no more living room debates, no more arguing and citing examples and quoting the famous dead and castigating the infamous living. No more running the government from our love seats, no more revamping of the tax code or philosophical fights about the role of government, the welfare state, the Swedish health system, designed by a Dr. Fioritos, no relation. The end of an era, never again, never on Sunday. The only people who stayed were Aunt Zoe, Father Mike, and our cousins, because they were related to us. Tessie was angry with Milton for causing a fight. She told him so. He exploded at her, and she gave him the silent treatment for the rest of the day. Father Mike took advantage of this to lead Tessie up to the sun deck. Milton got in his car and drove off. I was with Aunt Zoe when we later brought refreshments up to the deck. I had just stepped out onto the gravel between the thick redwood railings when I saw Tessie and Father Mike sitting on the black iron patio furniture. Father Mike was holding my mother's hand, leaning his bearded face close to her and looking into her eyes as he spoke softly. My mother had been crying, apparently. She had a tissue balled in one hand.
"Callie's got iced tea," Aunt Zoe announced as she came out. "And I've got the booze."
But then she saw how Father Mike was looking at my mother,
and she went silent. My mother stood up, blushing.
I'll take the booze, Zoe.
Everyone laughed nervously. Aunt Zoe poured the glasses.
Oh, look, Mike, she said. The Presbytera's getting drunk on Sunday.
The following Friday, I drove up with the object's father to their summer house near Petoskey. It was a grand Victorian, covered with gingerbread and painted the color of pistachio saltwater taffy. I was dazzled by the sight of the house as we drove up. It sat on a rise above Little Traverse Bay, guarded by tall pines, all its windows blazing. I was good with parents. Parents were my specialty. In the car on the way up, I had carried on a lively and wide-ranging conversation with the object's father. It was from him that she had gotten her coloring. Mr. Object had the Celtic tints. He was in his late 50s, however, and his reddish hair had been bleached almost colorless now, like a dandelion gone to seed. His freckled skin looked blown out, too. He wore a khaki poplin suit and bow tie. After he picked me up, we stopped at a party store near the highway where Mr. Object bought a six-pack of Smirnoff cocktails.
Martinis in a can, Callie. We live in an age of wonders.
5 hours later, not at all sober, he turned up the unpaved road that led to the summer house. It was 10 o'clock by this time. In moonlight, we carried our bags up to the back porch. Mushrooms dotted the pine needle path between the thin gray pines. Next to the house, an artesian well chimed among mossy rocks. When we came in the kitchen door, we found Jerome. He was sitting at the table reading the Weekly World News. The pallor of his face suggested that he had been there pretty much all month. His lustreless black hair looked particularly inert. He had on a Frankenstein t-shirt, seersucker shorts, white canvas topsiders without socks.
"I present to you Mr. Phonides," Mr. Object said. "Welcome to the hinterland."
Jerome stood up and shook his father's hand. They attempted a hug.
"Where's your mother?"
"She's upstairs getting dressed for the party you're incredibly late for. Her mood reflects that."
"Why don't you take Callie up to her room? Show her around."
"Check," said Jerome.
We went up the back stairs off the kitchen.
"The guest room's being painted," Jerome told me. "So you're staying in my sister's room."
"Where's she?"
"She's out on the back porch with Rex."
My blood stopped.
"Rex Reese?" "His rents have a place up here, too."
Jerome then showed me the essentials, guest towels, bathroom location, how to work the lights. But his manners were lost on me. I was wondering why the object hadn't mentioned anything about Rex on the phone. She had been up here 3 weeks and said nothing. We came back into her bedroom. Her rumpled clothes lay on the unmade bed. There was a dirty ashtray on one pillow.
"My little sister's a creature of slovenly habits," Jerome said, looking around. "Are you neat?"
I nodded.
"Me too. Only way to be."
"Hey." He came around to face me now.
"What happened to your trip to Turkey?"
"It got canceled."
"Excellent. Now you can be in my film. I'm shooting it up here. Are you up for that?"
"I thought it took place in a boarding school."
"I decided to make it a boarding school in the boonies."
Jerome was standing somewhat close to me. His hands flopped around in his pockets as he squinted at me and rocked on his heels.
"Should we go downstairs?" I finally asked.
"What?
Oh, right. Yeah, let's go."
Jerome turned and bolted. I followed him back down and through the kitchen. As we were crossing the living room, I heard voices out on the porch.
"So Selfridge, that lightweight, pukes," Rex Reese was saying. "Doesn't even make it to the bathroom. Pukes right on the bar."
"I can't believe it. Selfridge?"
It was the object now, crying out with amusement.
"He blew chunks right into his stinger. I couldn't believe it. It was like the Niagara Falls of puke. Selfridge whoops on the bar and everybody jumps off their stools, right? Selfridge is face down in his own puke. For a minute, there's total silence. Then this one girl starts gagging, and it's like a chain reaction. The whole place starts gagging, pukes dripping everywhere, and the bartender is pissed. He's huge, too. He's fucking huge. Comes over and looks down at Selfridge. I'm going like, I don't know this guy, never saw him before. And then guess what?"
"What?"
The bartender reaches out and grabs hold of Selfridge. He got him by the collar and the belt, right? And he lifts Selfridge like a foot up in the air and zambonies the bar with him. No way! I'm not kidding. Zambonied the fridge right in his own barf.
At that point, we stepped out onto the porch. The object and Rex Reese were sitting together on a white wicker couch. It was dark out, coolish, but the object was still in her swimsuit, a shamrock bikini. She had a beach towel wrapped around her legs. "Hi," I called out. The object turned. She looked at me blankly. "Hey," she said.
"She's here," said Jerome, "safe and sound. Dad didn't run off the road."
"Daddy's not that bad a driver," said the object.
"When he's not drinking, he's not. But tonight, I'd wager he had the old martini thermos on the front seat."
"Your old man likes to party," Rex called out hoarsely.
"Did my dad have occasion to quench his thirst on the drive up?" Jerome asked.
"More than one occasion," I said.
Now Jerome laughed, going loose in the body and slapping his hands together. Meanwhile, Rex was saying to the object,
"Okay, she's here, so let's party."
"Where should we go?" the object said.
"Hey, Jerome, didn't you say there was some old hunting lodge out in the woods?"
"Yeah, it's about half a mile in."
"Think you could find it in the dark? With a flashlight, maybe."
"Let's go," Rex stood up.
"Let's take some beers and hike on in there."
The object got up, too. "Let me put on some pants." She crossed the porch in her swimsuit. Rex watched.
"Come on, Callie," she said. "You're staying in my room."
I followed the object inside. She went quickly, almost running, and didn't look back at me. As she climbed the stairs ahead of me, I whacked her from behind. "I hate you," I said.
"What? You're so tan."
She flashed a smile over her shoulder. As the object dressed, I snooped around the bedroom. The furniture was white wicker up here, too. There were amateur sailing prints on the walls, and on the shelves, Petoskey stones, pine cones, musty paperbacks.
"What are we going to do in the woods?"
I said with a note of complaint. The object didn't answer.
"What are we going to do in the woods?" I repeated.
"We're going for a walk," she said.
"You just want Rex to molest you."
"You have such a dirty mind, Callie.
Don't deny it."
She turned around and smiled.
"I know who wants to molest you," she said.
For a second, an irrepressible happiness flooded me.
"Jerome," she finished.
"I don't want to go in the woods," I said. "There's bugs and stuff."
"Don't be such a wuss," she said.
I had never heard her say wuss before. It was a word boys used, boys like Rex. Finished dressing, the object stood before the mirror, picking at some dry skin on her cheek. She ran a brush through her hair and put on lip gloss. Then she came over to me. She came up very close. She opened her mouth and blew her breath into my face.
"It's fine," I said, and moved away.
"Don't you want me to check yours?"
"No biggie," I said.
I decided that if the object was going to ignore me and flirt with Rex, I would ignore her and flirt with Jerome. After she left, I combed my hair. From the collection of atomizers on the dresser, I chose one and squeezed the bulb, but no perfume came out. I went into the bathroom and undid the straps of my overalls. Lifting my shirt, I stuffed a few tissues in my brassiere. Then I shook my hair back, hitched up my overalls, and hurried outside for our walk in the woods. They were waiting for me under a yellow bug light on the porch. Jerome held a silver flashlight. Slung over Rex's shoulder was an army surplus backpack filled with strows. We came down the steps onto the lawn. The ground was uneven, treacherous with roots, but the pine needles were soft underfoot. For a moment, despite my foul mood, I felt it, the crisp northern Michigan delight. A slight chill to the air, even in August, something almost Russian. The indigo sky above the black bay, the smell of cedar and pine. At the edge of the woods, the object stopped.
"Is it going to be wet?" she said.
"I only have my tree torns on."
"Come on," said Rex Reese, pulling her by the hand. "Get wet." She screamed theatrically.
Leaning back like someone on a rope tow, she was pulled unsteadily into the trees. I paused, too, peering in, waiting for Jerome to do the same. He didn't, though. Instead, he stepped straight into the swamp and then slowly melted below the knees.
"Quicksand!" he cried. "Help me! I'm sinking! Please, somebody help! Glub, 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 glub!"
Up ahead, already invisible, Rex and the object were laughing. The Cedar Swamp was an ancient place. No logging had ever been done here. The ground wasn't suitable for houses. The trees had been alive for hundreds of years, and when they fell over for good. Here, in the Cedar Swamp, verticality wasn't an essential property of trees. Many cedars were standing straight up, but many were leaning over. Still others had fallen against nearby trees or crashed to the ground, popping up root systems. There was a graveyard feeling, everywhere the gray skeletons of trees. The moonlight, filtering in, lit up silver puddles and sprays of cobweb. It glanced off the object's red hair as she moved and darted ahead of me. We made a clumsy yahoo progress through the swamp. Rex imitated animal sounds that sounded like no animal. Beer cans dinged in his backpack. Our deracinated feet stomped along in the mud. After 20 minutes, we found it. A one-room shack made of unpainted boards. The roof wasn't much taller than I was. The circular flashlight beam showed tar paper covering the narrow door.
"It's locked! Fuck!" said Rex.
"Let's try the window," Jerome suggested. They disappeared, leaving the object and me alone. I looked at her. For the first time since I'd arrived, she really looked at me. There was just enough moonlight to accomplish the silent exchange between our eyes. "It's dark out here," I said. "I know it," said the object. There was a crash behind the shack, followed by laughter. The object took a step closer to me. "What are they doing in there?" "I don't know." Suddenly, the small window of the shack lit up. The boys had lit a Coleman lantern inside. Next, the front door opened and Rex stepped out. He was smiling like a salesman.
"Got a guy here, wants to meet you."
At which point, he held up a mousetrap dangling the jellied mouse. The object screamed, "Rex!" She jumped back and held on to me. "Take it away!" Rex dangled it some more, laughing, and then tossed it into the woods.
"Okay, okay, don't have a shit fit."
He went back inside. The object was still clinging to me. "Maybe we should go back," I ventured. "Do you think you know the way? I'm totally lost." "I can find it." She turned and looked into the black woods. She was thinking about it. But then Rex reappeared in the doorway.
"Come on in," he said. "Check it out."
And now it was too late. The object let go of me. Throwing the red scarf of her hair over her shoulder, she ducked through the low threshold into the hunting shack. Inside were two cots with Hudson's Bay blankets. They stood at either end of the small space, separated by a crude kitchen with a camp stove. Empty bourbon bottles lined the windowsill. The walls were covered with yellowed clippings from the local paper, angling competitions, soapbox derbies. There was also a taxidermied pike, jaws agape. Low on kerosene, the lantern sputtered. The light was butter-colored, the ripple of smoke greasing the air. It was opium den light, which was appropriate, because already Rex had plucked a joint from his pocket and was lighting it with a safety match. Rex was on one cot, Jerome on the other. Casually, the object sat down next to Rex. I stood in the middle of the floor, hunching. I could feel Jerome watching me. I pretended to examine the shack, but then turned, expecting to meet his gaze. This didn't happen, however. Jerome's eyes were focused on my chest, on my falsies. He liked me already. Now here was an added attraction, like a bonus for good intentions. Maybe I should have been pleased by the trance he was in, but my revenge fantasy had already gone bust. My heart wasn't in it. Still, having no alternative, I went ahead and sat beside Jerome. Across the shack, Rex Reese had the joint in his mouth. Rex was wearing shorts and a monogram shirt, ripped at the shoulder, showing tan skin. There was a red mark on his flamenco dancer's neck. A bug bite? A fading hickey? He closed his eyes to inhale deeply, his long eyelashes coming together. The hair on his head was as thick and oiled as an otter's pelt. Finally, he opened his eyes and passed the joint to the object. To my surprise, she took it As though it were one of her beloved Territons, she put it between her lips and inhaled.
"Won't that make you paranoid?" I said.
"No.
I thought you told me pot always makes you paranoid."
"Not when I'm out in nature," said the object. She gave me a hard look. Then she took another toke.
"Don't bogart it," said Jerome.
He got up to take the joint from her. He smoked, half standing, and then turned and held it out to me. I looked at the joint. One end burned, the other was mashed and wet. I had an idea that this was all part of the boy's plan. The woods, the shack, the cots, the drugs, the sharing of saliva. Here's a question I still can't answer. Did I see through the male tricks because I was destined to scheme that way myself? Or do girls see through the tricks too, and just pretend not to notice? For one second, I thought of Chapter 11. He was living in a shack in the woods like this. I asked myself if I missed my brother. I couldn't tell if I did or not. I never know what I feel until it's too late. Chapter 11 had smoked his first joint at college. I was 4 years ahead of him.
"Hold it in," Rex coached me.
"You have to let the THC build up in your bloodstream," said Jerome. There was a sound out in the woods, twigs snapping. The object grabbed Rex's arm.
"What was that?"
"Maybe a bear," Jerome said. "Neither of you girls are on the rag, I hope," said Rex.
"Rex," the object protested.
"Hey, I'm serious. Bears can smell it. I was out camping in Yellowstone one time, and there was this woman out there who got killed. Grizzly could smell the blood."
"That is not true. I swear. This guy I know told me. He was an outward bound guide."
"Well, I don't know about Callie, but I'm not," said the object. They all looked at me. "I'm not either," I said.
"I guess we're safe then, Roman," said Rex and laughed.
The object was still holding on to him for protection.
"You want to do a shotgun?" he asked her.
"What's that?"
"Here." He turned to face her. "What you do is, one person opens their mouth and the other person blows the smoke into it. You get totally fucked up. It's excellent."
Rex put the lid end of the joint in his mouth. He leaned toward the object. She leaned forward, too. She opened her mouth, and Rex began to blow. The obscure object's lips were a perfect ripe oval. And into that target, that bullseye, Rex Reese directed the stream of musky smoke. I could see the column rush into the object's mouth. It disappeared down her throat like white water over falls. Finally, she coughed, and he stopped.
"Good hit! Now do me."
The object's green eyes were watering, but she took the joint and inserted it between her lips. She leaned toward Rex Reese, who opened his own mouth wide. When they were finished, Jerome took the joint from his sister.
"Let me see if I can master the technical difficulties here," he said.
The next thing I knew, his face was close to mine. So finally I did it too, leaned forward, closed my eyes, parted my lips, and let Jerome shotgun into my mouth a long, dirty plume of smoke. Smoke filled my lungs, which began to burn. I coughed and let it out. When I opened my eyes again, Rex had his arm around the object's shoulder. She was trying to act casual about it. Rex finished his beer. He opened two more, one for him and one for her. He turned toward the object. He smiled. He said something I couldn't hear, and then, while I was still blinking, he covered the object's lips with his sour, handsome, pot-smoking mouth. Across the flickering shack, Jerome and I were left pretending not to notice. The joint was ours now to bogart as we wished. We passed it back and forth in silence and sipped our beers.
"I'm having this weird thing where my feet look extremely far away," Jerome said after a while. "Do your feet look extremely far away to you?"
"I can't see my feet," I said. "It's dark in here."
He passed me the joint again, and I took it. I inhaled and held the smoke in. I let it keep burning my lungs because I wanted to distract myself from the pain in my heart. Rex and the object were still kissing. I looked away out the dark, grimy window.
"Everything looks really blue," I said. "Did you notice that?"
"Oh, yeah," said Jerome. "All kinds of strange epiphenomena."
The Oracle of Delphi had been a girl about my same age. All day she sat over a hole in the ground, the umphalos, the navel of the earth, breathing petrochemical fumes escaping from underneath. A teenage virgin, the oracle, told the future, speaking the first metered verse in history. Why do I bring this up? Because Calliope was also a virgin that night, for a little while longer at least. And she, too, had been inhaling hallucinogens. Etheline was escaping from the cedar swamp outside the shack, dressed not in a diaphanous robe, but a pair